This is 4:55 on Wednesday, December 7th.
Well, it is time. Looking at the calendar, today is the 7th. Chapter 8 and Proxy Project are due on Friday. Due to the short time between the Chapter 8 due date and the exam, I think I will again post answers, which means that answers received after the answers are posted won't count. So we'll do that. This is a new problem I haven't had before of having two things due on the same day. So there's one turn-in page for both of them. Make sure that you name the files that you submit correctly for the two projects, so we can separate for the project and the assignment, so we can separate those out and get the right things into the right grading path. But just upload them both to the same page. Okay? And finally, please do course evaluations. Keep reminding you about that. Any questions about logistics? Any questions about the project? People are having some issues with the chunk encoding stuff, I'm guessing, from the questions I'm getting. Yes?
So I noticed that as it's processing, it's still receiving, it won't load the page, because when I stop my server, it loads the page. And I don't think it's not in
that. Ah, we got an answer to that.
Okay, so if you read it from the socket, instead of checking until the read is zero, check until you get the line break, the double line break. And then that way it'll get the header, and then it will stop reading from the socket normally.
So it's not until it's not from zero until the last line break?
Yeah.
How do you know it's the last line break,
though? So you have to... So when you get your byte array, you immediately check the string, and if the string has a double line break, then you just break from the loop.
Actually, I haven't said check the bytes because I was getting data corruption on binary files.
No, I'm not talking about that. You don't change your byte array to a string. You just check the string encoding of it.
Right. It's important that, are you talking about in chunk encoding?
Yeah.
So it's important in chunk encoding that you actually deliver all of the data that has been promised by chunk encoding, which means all the way to the chunk that's of zero length plus the carriage return line feed after it.
Okay.
If you don't do that, the browser thinks more is coming.
Right.
And the reason that it's displaying the page when you close your proxy server is because the socket is then being closed, the browser does a zero read and says, oh, there's no more coming.
So right.
It just displays what it has. It's still not happy, right? Because it hasn't got everything it was promised.
Okay.
But that's typically what's going on when the browser doesn't show you something and you think you've sent it. It's because it thinks more is coming. You got to make sure you delivered everything that needs to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kim.
I haven't noticed a transfer encoding header on any of my.
Yeah, so CNN used to use transfer encoding chunk. I'm hearing that it doesn't anymore.
I get it with CNN.
You do get it with CNN.
I get a lot of requests when I
my request cnn.com,
uh-huh.
it probably sends like 10 requests. And it, well, it sends one request and the server sends a bunch of.
Right.
Yes, a bunch of that.
Right.
And like the last one is a chunk
of
code.
Is a chunk of code. Okay. All right. So it's not all of them. All right.
Okay.
Cool. So, and it may be that it's some site that CNN is referring to that's doing that. I don't know. But
is it possible that some of the information on the CNN webpage is actually just using HTTPS? I don't know if that's possible. Because I know that sometimes not all of this. This might have to do with what we were talking about a few minutes ago, but
mm-hmm.
some of it isn't, like the headers in the server response say 302 moved permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that's probably because it's talking about HTTPS.
Well, no, it doesn't necessarily mean HTTPS. Moved permanently can be a redirection to another HTTP location as well. You should be able to look at that header in the debuggles and see what it says about the new location. Okay? And so then you'll know whether it's HTTPS or not. If it's referring to HTTPS, that's fine.
Right.
Yeah, that won't be an issue. But it's an item of curiosity, certainly. Others? Okay.
Let's continue to talk about some security topics then.
Sorry, one quick
question. Oh, sure, yeah.
So the calendar, it says that there's supposed to be an image here, but do you actually
There is no image
okay.
there.
Okay,
it's
cool.
missing. Yeah, even if you look at it without the proxy server, you'll never see an image
yeah,
there.
Because
the image I used to use is gone from where it was, and I haven't replaced it with anything new. All right, so last time we talked about certificates and certificate authorities. I'm going to skip over the section on securing email. You can read that. I want to talk about
SSL. So the first thing to know about SSL is that if you go around talking about SSL these days, you're going to be thought of as being behind the times. Because the current standards call it TLS. So SSL stands for Secure Socket Layer, and it was invented by a company called Netscape. Anybody remember Netscape? Netscape? What?
What?
What? Netscape? All right. So Firefox is the intellectual inheritor of the Netscape code base, but the Netscape company is long gone, driven out of business by shenanigans by Microsoft way back in the 1990s. So SSL was invented by Netscape. It's the foundation for the idea of HTTPS, secure web browsing. But once it sort of moved into the standardization process, it got renamed and is now known as TLS, Transport Layer Security. So you can see, I would say the book is behind the times by calling it SSL. See, they call it TLS is a variation, but now TLS is the thing. And the old, and any sites that are still using SSL, the SSL protocol, or the early versions of TLS are now considered insecure. So people should be moving on to current versions of TLS. It provides confidentiality, integrity, CIA, 3A, CI actually. A stands for availability in CIA, and this is authentication, which is related to integrity. Anyway, provides both of those. It does the authentication for the server end of the connection, but does not do it typically for the client end of the connection, because why?
Why would it be much more likely that we would be authenticating servers than clients?
We want to know if we're talking to the right server.
Well, we definitely want to know we're talking to the right server. Why don't we want to know we're talking to the right client?
There's a lot of clients.
There are a lot of clients, right? Every one of us is a client. Every one of our computers is a client, and our phones and so forth. And how does this work? It uses the certificate idea that we talked about last time. Do we all want to go off and get certificates and install them in our browsers for us personally in order to do anything on the web? Probably not. Or at least the people who want to have their servers talk to us don't want to rely on that. Maybe we should, but they don't want to rely on that. So typically, we're just authenticating the server and the connection. And HTTPS is really the basis of being able to do commerce on the web, banking, buying things, sending credit cards, because it's the thing that lets us use encrypted data transfer, first of all, and also to make sure that we're talking to the service that we think we're talking to.
The abstraction that TLS provides is
really, I think, nicely described by the name Secure Socket Layer. Essentially, it gives us an interface to creating and using sockets that provide security. And so it's essentially the socket interface with security wedged underneath. It's typically implemented as an application layer protocol, right? So it sits between TCP, the transport layer protocol, and the application, but it's implemented in a library that is used from your programming language. It's not implemented by the operating system layer. So here's the picture of what I just said. It's wedged in here between TCP and the application, and really the operating system interface is right here, user. So there are some issues about doing authentication and encryption on streams of data that we haven't really talked about. We've talked about earlier when we talked about signing things, we said, all right, so we're going to take this message, we're going to hash it, we're going to encrypt the hash with the public key of the recipient, and that will constitute the signature. Right? The problem with doing this for something like a TCP stream is that we don't want to wait until the end of the stream in order to start signing things, right? It's important that we be able to sign little pieces along the way. And so
that's what SSL does.
Essentially, it breaks the communication stream up into chunks and signs and encrypts the individual chunks so that at the other end we can unpack those and know that the ongoing conversation is legitimate. So it starts with a handshake. Remember, TCP also starts with a handshake. The SSL handshake occurs after the TCP handshake. So guess what? This protocol is going to involve yet another round-trip delay in order to establish the connection. Remember, TCP already has the TCP handshake that takes a round-trip delay before you can start the things. Here's more round-trip delay. They have to essentially authenticate one another and establish the session key. We've talked about that. It says authenticate each other, but as I earlier said, it's typically a one-way authentication these days. Then we break things up into chunks that can be signed and encrypted, and that goes on for as long as it needs to go on. And this is sort of an interesting point about the whole thing. It turns out that from the perspective of wanting to do things securely, it's not enough just to encrypt and authenticate the data. You also need to make sure that you've received everything that you were supposed to have received, right? So connection closure is itself something that needs to be authenticated. That makes sense? Like for example, suppose I were telling you to transfer some money over one of these connections, and you'd received all the instructions that said transfer all this money, except at the end of the protocol, the application protocol, there was the opportunity to say forget all that, right? So what happens if the connection gets closed before it reaches the point where I've had the opportunity to gets closed from the recipient? After I've said forget all that, but the recipient hasn't gotten the forget all that message, then the recipient thinks it was a good thing and goes ahead and does it, and it's wrong, right? So connection closure is also something that needs to be protected by these cryptographic mechanisms. Okay, so then it goes through some of the ideas of this. As it said during the handshake, we sort of do the authentication, and then we send a master secret, or the encrypted master secret, to the other side, which becomes the basis of using symmetric key cryptography. Why do we use symmetric key? Want to use symmetric key cryptography from this point forward? Instead of public key cryptography? What's
more
the
secure.
What?
It's more secure.
No, it's not more secure. It's faster. Right? It requires less computational resources typically to use the symmetric key algorithms than the public key ones. What's that?
He said duh.
All right. But out of an abundance of caution, that master secret is not used directly for the key. Instead, it's run through some algorithms that generate encryption keys for the separate encryption keys for both directions and separate signing keys for both directions, just because it's thought to be generally a bad idea to use a single key for multiple purposes. But
sort of fundamentally, that's just good practice rather than anything. Okay, so then we chop things up into records. We sign them with we append max. We put sequence numbers in things. There's all kinds of little gotchas here that have to be dealt with. Making sure that we protect the lengths of things and the sequence numbers of things. And it turns out that this SSL or TLS scheme is intended to have a long life in the world, so the protocol itself is somewhat agnostic as to which encryption algorithms are used. You can pick one or another, and
this
is a good point to do something which, let's see if I can do this. All right. So SSLLabs.com is a service that's provided that will do analysis of the configuration of the SSL
implementation on any server, and what's a good server to use? Well, we'll use the same victim that we used last time.
mail.vcea.wsu.edu.
Okay, so it will go off and it will determine what protocols this server supports and then provide a grade as to how likely it thinks that this can be attacked using known attacks.
Make this a little bigger. It's still working.
See that word there? Deprecated cipher suites. Remember I said MD5 is bad and SHA-1 may be bad. What it's doing is it's saying, server, do you support this? Do you support that? Do you support the other thing? Alright, we're going to leave that going. It says it has about... I think it's overestimating how long it's going to take. Yeah. We'll wait. When it said almost 10 minutes to go, I thought we'd go away, but it's going much faster than that. So there are known vulnerabilities in some implementations of TLS. It checks those.
Microsoft problem.
Gets an A. Should I do the EECS one just for fun?
Connect, that's even worse.
What? connect.wsu.edu. We can do that. Why not? We'll start that one going and then and just to be polite, we won't broadcast the university's weaknesses. You see, there are places that get F's. Right? Mail.vc, it hit the leaderboard there for for a second. Let's do this one, but we won't publicize this one, and we'll go back and look at this one. All right. So what all did it do? It
inspected the certificate to see whether the certificate itself was good.
It does say that there are chain issues. So it not only does it inspect the local certificate, it inspects all the certificates that relies on. That's cool. What protocols does it support?
The good ones, the TLS ones, the SSL ones are deprecated, so we don't support those. So if you have a browser that only supports those, we won't talk to you. That's good for you. The cipher suites. So, RSA. That would be so RSA and AES and SHA-384, AES-256. Okay. So all of these are considered okay, apparently.
Now this is interesting.
One of the things you might want to know is if you use a different kind of client to access this server, what are you going to get in the way of encryption? And so it will try a bunch of these. And it tells you what the operating system supports or the application supports, and it tells you then what you end up with as the security.
maybe you care, maybe you don't. Hi.
Can you remind me what TLS stands for?
Transport Layer Security. TLS.
Yeah.
Like
protocol?
Yeah, that's the protocol. That's the name of the protocol. And it comes in versions 1.0, 1.1, and 1.2 these days. Okay. So what can't you talk to this server with? You can't talk to it with Internet Explorer 6. In Windows XP. And you can't talk to it with Internet Explorer 8 in Windows XP. That's a good thing, right? Because those browsers only support things that are considered insecure, and the server won't have anything to do with them. What else? Session resumption. I believe session resumption is buggy in TLS, and therefore it's a good thing not to support it. So this would be the idea that you could make a TCP connection, have the TCP connection fail, and come back later with information about the TLS connection and establish it over a new TCP connection. As I said, I think it's buggy and better to be turned off. And underlying it, we have HTTP 1.1, and everybody's happy, and so on and so forth. Okay, just a sec. Let's switch over to this one. This is connect.wsu.edu. We'll look at what's different about it and see why it got us in. Yeah?
Well, I was going to ask, is there a header in an HTTP request that says what kind of operating system you're sending a request from?
No. There might be.
How do you know if there's a distinction between requests from your Explorer 6 on the XP operating system?
Oh, so the reason, let's go back to that. So it's not doing this based on information that's in the request. Rather, this testing process is using a negotiation that looks like what that operating system would do,
okay.
That browser and operating system would do. Okay. So it's not that the server is responding differently based on information that's in the headers, it's rather responding differently based on what that operating system does in the form of negotiation. Okay? Excellent question. So why does connect.wsu get a C? It's got a good certificate. We'll look at what protocols it supports and what cipher strengths it supports. It doesn't support TLS 1.2, right? So even if you've got a good client, this server is not going to be very helpful. It uses SSL3, obsolete and unsecure. It's very likely that, sometime in the next year or two, major browsers are going to stop being willing to talk to these servers. Protect what? It doesn't support TLS 1.2, which means the best it can get, which is a C. Accepts RC4 cipher. RC4 cipher is known to have insecurities. Okay. And so on and so forth. Okay, so if you have an SSH site that you're interested in, you can, SSL site you're interested in, you can inspect it with this tool. Okay, so you get a sense of sort of what's good and what's bad with SSL these days. Questions? So we're not going to go over these details, but how it does it.
Rather, I want to move on to IPsec.
So we saw the picture that had SSL or TLS in between TCP and an application. So it's something that protects a single TCP connection between a client and a server. It's really application level security for a single connection. IPsec, which came along about the same time as IP version 6 and was part of IP version 6, IP, Internet Protocol Security, means protecting all of the traffic between a host and either another particular host or another whole subnet, right? So again, we're going to be interested in things like encryption and authentication. But what's different here is that because it's operating at the IP layer instead of the transport layer, it's think back to our model of what that means. At the IP layer, we're talking about communication from one host to another host. At the transport layer, we're talking about communication from one application to another application. Right? Demultiplexing occurs at the transport layer. So by moving down a layer, we're able to protect all the traffic between one host and another, or even between one host and a whole subnet. So, and this is then the basis of something you may have heard of called virtual private networks. People heard of virtual private networks? The idea that we can run a network over essentially the public internet that nevertheless preserves the confidentiality of all of the information that passes over it and limits it only to the designated endpoints. So I think there's a picture here of that. The way that's done is typically to have gateway routers that handle the IPsec behavior when you're attaching to a subnet, and then they usually also allow people who are mobile to participate in these things by running IPsec software directly on laptops and other individual machines. WSU actually supports this after fashion. I don't use it, so I don't know how well it works, but my experience with it back many years ago was that it was kind of clunky and not easy to use, whereas what I do is very limited. I use something called Secure Shell, which is closely related to TLS, but isn't TLS, to make application layer connections between my home machine and my office machine, and that's how I find it easier to work. Because I don't need general connectivity from home to work, I just need to be able to run a shell or see a web page or something like that, and that can be set up at the application layer more easily than this IPsec stuff is. So what does it provide? It provides data integrity and origin authentication, prevents replay attacks, and provides confidentiality, the usual set of things. It actually comes with two different service models called authentication header, I think, and encapsulating security payload. I got that right. This one is just authentication. This one has authentication and encryption both. These days, the capability of computers to do symmetric key encryption algorithms is do them fast is so good that
people rather more or less just abandoned the simpler one because this one's way better and it doesn't cost you anything more really, so why not use the thing that's way better?
At the time this was invented, ESP was expensive in terms of latency. Computers couldn't do that encryption that fast, but nowadays it seems fine. Okay, and so that's one dimension, AH versus ESP. And the other dimension is whether we're doing encryption between, or doing IPsec between end hosts or between networks, and or some combination of the two. So transport mode is when we're doing IPsec between individual hosts, and tunneling mode is when we're doing IPsec between essentially routers. So in tunneling mode, what we're really doing is providing access to this entire network, which is unencrypted over IPsec, and in transport mode, it's encrypted all the way host to host. Again, tunneling mode is probably a lot more popular because management of the IPsec capabilities on end hosts is a pain in the neck. So I talked about that. Four combinations. All right, so I said ESP is preferred, and tunnel mode is what you usually see because it can be managed by the administrators of a network rather than the end users of the system. Okay, then there's a long discussion about sort of the data that is kept in hosts that are participating in IPsec networking, and I think if you ever have to set one of these up, you need to know this, but I think as general knowledge it's not very interesting, so we're going to skip over that. But this is sort of important. As you read the book and look at the slides, make sure that you understand where things are encrypted and where they're not, and who's doing the encrypting and who's seeing things in the clear. Okay? So, for example, in this one where we're using tunnel mode, all of the encryption and decryption happens on the routers, on the subnets off to the side. Traffic is just in the clear like any other subnet because there are likely many more machines on this network. Okay, so pretty straightforward. Oh, just a remark about this. For some reason, people had a sense of humor when they were designing this, and enchilada is actually a technical term. IPsec. There's the enchilada, and then there's the whole enchilada. Okay. It's amazing. Okay, so that's that. What's inside the enchilada? We still need sequence numbers to prevent replay attacks. More data. The databases are just the tables that govern the thing. Anyway, okay. In order to establish the keying associated with IPsec, there's another protocol called Internet Key Exchange, and we're not going to go over that at all. But just recognize that the purpose of that is to set up the session keys that are needed for IPsec. And it supports pre-shared keys, in other words, symmetric things, and certificates. Anyway. So we're going to do section 8.7 on Friday. So we'll come back to that.
maybe we'll have to finish this too, but I want to get started on this. Firewalls. So everything we've talked about so far has sort of been at the protocol level, and now let's talk about other things that happen associated with security. And one of the biggest things that's associated with securing networks is the installation of firewalls, which are computers that inspect the traffic going across them to form a boundary between an outside and an inside. That's what a firewall does. And the goal of the firewall is to keep the inside from being exposed to bad stuff from the outside. And some firewalls also try to keep secret information that should remain inside, inside. Okay? So suppose you have an Edward Snowden inside. One of the goals of a firewall might be to keep him from sending data outside. That's another thing that can happen there. That's the general idea. So, what can they do for you? One thing they can do is keep bogus connections from showing up inside your network. They can just sort of get rid of a lot of garbage that shouldn't be there. And I'm not going to talk about the SYN flood attack, but you know, suppose there are a lot of people trying to connect to your systems in your network and you don't want to talk to them, a firewall can just keep that all away from them. A firewall can't prevent denial of service attacks against your public network connection. Right? If somebody can use up the bandwidth of your public internet connection by interacting with your firewall, then you have a denial of service attack. No problem. But by preventing certain kinds of connections inside, you can help prevent that. All right. We don't want to let people get into internal data in different ways. And as I said, we don't want to let information leak out, maybe. So there are several types of firewalls. And I don't, at this stage, I wouldn't necessarily say they're types of firewalls. They're approaches to doing firewalling. And any given firewall may mix and match these ideas in different ways. But
we're going to go over those.
So a stateless firewall only looks at individual packets. It just says, given this packet, and what can I see, what I can see in it, and what does it typically look at? It looks at the source IP, the destination IP, the source port, the destination port. It makes a decision about whether this packet should be allowed across the firewall or not. Very simple. It can look at the TCP SYN. Anyway, all in all, it just looks at what's in the packet. That's stateless firewall. It's very simple. Probably not used very much anymore. Even home routers have much more capability than this. Sort of as technology has improved for computation, it's gotten easier to implement more complicated things.
So I think we'll skip over that.
But so firewalls are expressed as a set of rules, and each of the rules says, look at a packet and do something with it. So in this case, if your policy is people inside can't use web servers outside, we'll just have a rule that says,
any traffic going to port 80 will drop it. Why is that not a very effective rule for blocking web access? Somebody chooses a different port. Yeah, okay. No incoming TCP connections except for the institution's public web server. So this is a situation where the public web server sits outside the firewall The web server is inside the firewall. The only thing that's allowed to come in is access to that web server. So we'll drop SYN packets except for those that are directed at the web server. Why does that work? And that's a very, seems like a very simple rule for protecting against traffic. Yeah?
If you can never handshake, you'll never have a stream.
Yeah, if you can never handshake, you'll never establish a stream. So even though this rule lets all kinds of other garbage traffic into my other machines, because they're not SYN packets, a stream can never be established, etc. Okay, you get the idea.
Simple things.
IT put in a new firewall 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Its firewall changes, it successfully blocked all research data coming into the university.
Yes.
Because of that exact rule.
That exact rule. Yeah.
Or a bunch of rules like that for different things. So, but not enough to cover the things that needed to be done. So the rules are typically expressed in a table that says, given the things that you inspect, what do you do with that packet? And the rules are inspected for each packet top to bottom. Whichever one hits is the one that is the one that is used. Whichever one hits first is the one that is used. That also is a really, from a security engineering point of view, that's a really big problem, because these tables, even in stateful firewalls, get to be hundreds or even thousands of rules long, and for any given packet, to understand what they do, you sort of have to trace through these thousands of rules and see what it hits. The policies don't spring out at you from the way the tables are expressed. So stateful filters track the status of connections, and know whether a connection has been established between two hosts or not, and those garbage packets that look like they're part of a TCP connection but don't set one up can be dropped. So that's stateful. But they work in a similar way with these tables that track the state. So now another kind of gateway is one where you have a really restrictive stateless or stateful firewall that just says only a particular machine is allowed to do outside interactions from inside the network, and hosts inside the network that want to do particular applications first contact that machine, which then gives them permission to get outside the firewall. And these have been built for all kinds of different protocols, but they're very application protocol specific. Yeah. At Xerox, when I was at Xerox, FTP, remember I said don't use FTP, but way back then, FTP was still a popular and widely used protocol. It's a pain in the neck for firewalling. And so we had one of these application gateways for FTP, and it was still a pain in the neck for firewalling, because you had to configure the FTP client machines elsewhere in the network to know to use the application gateway. And FTP clients at the time were not easily configurable, and so that was a big mess.
Don't use FTP. That's have I said that before? Yes, I have. Okay. So then there's something that the book doesn't talk about, which is the so-called deep inspection firewalls. I'm really over time, aren't I? You guys are not. I'm not either awake or fascinating or
no
something. I think I better stop. We'll talk about deep inspection next time.
It's all good.
Everybody having fun.